This chapter belongs together as an entire unit. I wasn't going to try to cover 40 verses, 39 verses in one message, however. Our understanding of any part is tied to the whole in varying degrees. Our understanding of this chapter is also tied to what we imagine the questions to have been. And sometimes you will find in commentaries they propose a question and then base their entire interpretation upon that. It's also important to consider the teaching elsewhere in this letter, and especially the teaching on Jesus, by Jesus, on the issue of marriage and divorce and remarriage, which will come later in the chapter. The entire chapter 7 is devoted to that topic, the topic of marriage. Because of Paul's specific wording, I believe that he is responding to just one question in verses 1 through 24, and possibly a related question started in verse 25. Some suppose additional questions in verses 8, 10, and 12, and at least in my version, the New International that I have in front of me, you'll find a paragraph division in verse 8, 10, and 12. Now to the unmarried and widows, 10 to the married, I give this command. To the rest, I say this in verse 12. I don't believe this is introducing new questions or answers to new questions, but are all based upon one initial, perhaps somewhat complex question which they posed that Paul is addressing starting in verse 1. If I had to guess what that question was, at least from the perspective of today, it could be worded this way. Is it healthy to go without sex? Shouldn't people get married so that they can have sex properly? For that reason, I wondered about giving another rating to this message as parental guidance recommended or PG-13 or something like that. That's one of the reasons why the overcomers have a class today. There were numerous forces pressing upon the Corinthians, many of those we would recognize as being present in our own culture. We have seen some of those in the first chapters. Sexual immorality was widespread in Corinth. It was an oversexed society, which is what I believe we could describe our own society, our own culture today. It was also a me-first culture. It was egocentric and proud. But there were also ascetic practices, which were particularly admired by some of the people in the ancient world. It was often portrayed as the answer to the extremes in other areas, which we often see is the case. People go to one extreme, and the answer people offer is some other extreme. Instead of coming back to the middle where God has created something, they go in either of the two extremes. Some so downplayed the physical and the body that they even considered them to be evil. And it was out of this context that the Corinthian believers raised their questions, and into which context Paul responds. A distortion of marriage and sex will not diminish as time goes on. 1 Timothy 4, the first three verses, Paul says, "The Spirit clearly says that in latter times some will abandon the faith. They will forbid people to marry. There are and will be those who will depart from the faith, and they will even forbid marriage." And this we find sometimes in religious, so-called Christian groups, that they have gone to the extreme of saying this is so wrong, you shouldn't even marry. Hebrews 13:4, the writer says, "Marriage should be honored by all, and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral." It's a battle to maintain a proper biblical position. Marriage and sex in marriage is good and pure. And sex outside of marriage is wrong. Paul will address some specific groups in the first half of this chapter. I read those briefly already, unmarried and widows. He'll address believing couples, and then couples in which one partner is a believer and the other not. First, however, in the first seven verses, he establishes certain general principles. And the focus in his response seems to be on singleness and abstinence from sexual relations. There's an English word, celibacy, which I believe is particularly appropriate for this. If you look it up in some dictionaries, they give a general meaning as abstinence from sex, but commonly has the specific sense of refraining from marriage. Within his response on celibacy, Paul gives some principles about sexual relations in marriage. Instead of treating the text in the exact order that it comes, I would like to address all three of the principles in the first seven verses that deal with celibacy, and then go back and look at sexual relations in marriage. I hope also to begin the first group in verses 8 and 9 of the unmarried and widows. The first principle which Paul gives in verse 1 is that celibacy is okay. Now, for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to marry. Now, the NIV interprets for us what literally, if you were to read it in some older translations as well, something that could cause some confusion. If you have the King James or even New American Standard, it might read, "It is good for a man not to touch a woman." I can remember when I was back in seminary, one man took this very literally and felt like you shouldn't have any physical contact as a man with a woman. The latter was that not to touch a woman was an idiomatic phrase which could have meant to marry. However, as you look at lexicons, this is the only place they suggest that. And as I did a word study, it revealed that it's more likely meant to have sexual relations. It was also an interesting word. It was used to touch off a fire when you light a fire. That's the same word that was used. The idea, perhaps, of to ignite passions. Another challenge in the translation arises from the fact that there are two words, primary words in Greek, which are translated man in our English versions. From the one, we get our English term anthropology, the study of man. It is often used in the general sense of human, although it can be used as a male. From the other word, we get such English words as android or androgamy, a few other that none of us, or most of us, have struggles with pronouncing them. It means an adult male, and is the word which is used in Greek also for husband. In this chapter, Paul uses that latter word 16 times, and the former one only 4. And the distinction he makes is very clear. In my mind, he is very careful which of these two words he chooses when he uses them. Unfortunately, when we read it, we read man, and we don't know which one he's using. In chapter 7, verse 2, when it says each woman should have her own husband, the second word there is a male, a husband. In 7:7, it says, "I wish that all men were as I am." It's the first word. I wish that all people, all humans, not all males. In verse 1, Paul deliberately chooses not the second, but the first word. He doesn't say it's good for a male not to touch a woman, which could have implied a husband, but just a general term, the man. It's good for a man, a person, not to touch a woman. He is saying, he's avoiding implying that a husband could properly withdraw from having sex. He has chosen a word which will not imply what he will go on to say is absolutely regulated in marriage. Paul is not merely saying that it's okay not to marry. He is saying it's okay not to marry, and in so doing, not to have sexual relations. Celibacy, an absence from sex due to not being married, is okay. Now, there are cultures in the world where this thought is totally foreign. Jim has related to me in some places. There are the belief that a man will get sick if he doesn't have sex. Our own culture is moving in that direction. In my lifetime, which is getting longer, The attitude toward sex outside of marriage has changed tremendously. 50 years ago, adultery and promiscuity were wrong. It was looked down upon. It was hidden. Men or women could be good friends without any questions. Men with men, women with women, no one questioned that. Both adultery and promiscuity, however, eventually became tolerated and then accepted. Now people plan for both of them. It is taught in school how to plan for it. Those who refrain are considered odd. Same-sex friendships are now misunderstood. In the schools, it is taught that sex as part of one's first relationship is normal and okay. And any sexual relationship is good if you feel good about it. That I know because I have observed what our children bring home. I have seen it in the textbooks, and I have gone and talked with the schools about it. And this is approved curriculum in the German schools. I suspect it's the same in the Swiss schools. I see some heads nodding up and down. The next step is to say that abstinence is not good. Paul speaks out against this trend. Celibacy, absence from sex because one has chosen not to marry, that's okay. It's a good thing. He's not saying this is what it must be. He's just saying it's okay. Something that our culture, if it's not already saying, will soon say, it's strange, it's odd if you don't. Second principle of celibacy versus marriage is that celibacy is not advisable when sexual temptation is strong. Verse 2, but since there is so much immorality, remember the context in Corinth, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Sexual immorality in Corinth was extreme. It was identified with being Corinthian. And this meant that the temptations were also strong. There was a psychological pressure. It was unnatural to be a Corinthian and not believe in sexual freedom. There was real physical temptation. There were no cultural barriers to it. It was available, and customers were sought. Now, we see that happening in our own culture. Ever since the internet became available in the home, and men could view pornography without worrying if they were seen, without worrying if someone would see it. The addiction in that area has increased tremendously. But the drive to have sex is not wrong in itself. There is a proper context, and that is marriage. And marriage is what Paul advises when sexual temptation is strong. There is to be satisfaction of that sexual drive in marriage, which Paul will develop more in these verses, in the first seven verses of chapter 7. Celibacy is okay, and it has its advantages, which Paul will develop later. But the drive for sexual intimacy is strong. And when someone senses strong temptation in that area and an inability to control, celibacy is not then a wise course to pursue. It is much better to seek marriage if that is possible. The third principle of celibacy versus marriage comes in verses 6 and 7. So if you will skip over the rest of 2 and 3, 4 and 5 and look at 6 and 7, we read that celibacy is a gift of God. Marriage is not commanded, but is a normal provision of God. Verse 6 reads, I say this as a concession, not a command. I wish that all men were as I am, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Paul does not command marriage or celibacy. Paul's statement in verse 6 could technically refer to any one of three things. It might refer to that which follows, that is, his wish that all were like him, but there are few who take this position. It might also refer to the immediate topic of temporary abstinence within marriage for the sake of prayer. He's talking about that in verses 5 and 6. But this topic he has treated in such definite terms, it would hardly be what he is saying to withdraw the force of that, to say, do not do this, to command, this is what must be, and then to say, well, I'm not commanding this. That just does not fit with the terms that he uses. It's much more likely that he's speaking to the entire theme of verses 1 to 7. He's not commanding either marriage or celibacy. Should I say this as a concession, as these are the options. I'm not commanding that you get married. I'm not commanding that you remain celibate. Celibacy is good, but marriage too is good and proper. Paul does see advantages to his own celibacy and wishes that others could take advantage of them as well. And he will develop these later in verses 26 and 28. He mentions a current crisis in Corinth. He says this will be the cause of many troubles for those who marry. So he suggests, if possible, it would be good not to marry. In verses 32 and following, he explains that celibacy also allows more undivided devotion to the Lord. He says, if you want to dedicate your life to the Lord, if you don't need to get married, well, perhaps not getting married is an acceptable choice for you. It must be said he is not anti-woman in this statement. As I mentioned already, he's not saying it's good for males not to marry. He said just generally, he wishes that all people, men and women, could remain celibate. He's also not anti-marriage. Some want to take this verse out of context and say, well, Paul was anti-marriage. He didn't think that much of marriage. His teaching elsewhere makes it clear that he does not have that position. Some of the passages I think I've listed in your notes, 1 Timothy 5, Ephesians 5, later in this book as well, 1 Corinthians 11. Marriage, he teaches, was created by God and as such was a part of a very good creation. My children still laugh at the message I gave at our oldest son's wedding because I emphasized what God said at the end of chapter 1. He went through 5 days of creation, and at the end of each day said, oh, this is good. On the sixth day, he created man and woman and marriage, and he looked at what he had created and said, this is very good. Marriage is a very good thing. And Paul supports that. It pictures also the relationship with Christ, between Christ and the church. And it mirrors the relationship between God the Father and God the Son. He encourages marriage elsewhere. So he's not anti-marriage. He holds a very high view of it. But there are certain things that need to be taken into consideration when facing that choice. Paul recognizes that living celibate is a gift of God. He might have this gift, but others may not. Each is gifted in a way that God has intended, and that gifting varies from person to person. In verse 7, reading again from 6, I say this as a concession, not a command. I wish all men were as I am, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. Some understand that Paul to be saying that celibacy and marriage are each their own gift from God. I do not believe that the two can be viewed as gifts in the same manner. A more literal translation of this verse would be, each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner, another in that. God's grace to us reveals itself in different manners. To live unmarried requires special grace of God. I believe this is to what Jesus refers when he talks with his disciples about marriage and divorce. If you want to look at that in Matthew chapter 19, we will be coming back to this in a few weeks as we look at the question of divorce and remarriage again. But they came, the Pharisees came asking to Jesus about divorce, and he responds to them. In verse 8, he says, Jesus permitted Jesus said, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another woman commits adultery. The disciples said to him, if this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it's better not to marry. Jesus replied, not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it has been given. For some are eunuchs because they were born that way, others were made that way by men, and others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept it. And it says not, there's those who are given this. I believe he's talking about celibacy, and for some a choice for the sake of the kingdom. And to those who make that choice, it needs to be given by God. There's a special grace of God to be able to do that. To get married is normal. It does not require God's grace in the same manner. But there is a manner in which even marriage recognizes God's grace. In Proverbs 18, it says, he who finds a wife finds what is good and receives favor or grace from the Lord. Also in Proverbs 19, verse 14, a prudent wife is from the Lord. God's provision in marriage is also a gift. Not existing in marriage, but being able to get married is a gift. So each in its own manner must be gifted. One, the gift of a spouse, and the other, the gift to be able to live that way. Celibate comes from God. And there are various practical issues with which we are sometimes confronted. There's the single person who wants to get married, but is not married, and does not appear to have that option. Sometimes such a person will say, well, I don't feel particularly gifted to live as a single person. What am I to do? And to this person, I would say two things. First, if God has not provided the option of marriage, then he will provide all that is needed to live righteously as an unmarried person. In 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, it says, no temptation has taken you but such as is common to man. But God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond which you are able to bear, but will with the temptation make a way, the old King James had a way of escape, or a way to endure or to bear up under it. You do not have to feel gifted to live righteously. That is true for everyone. A second point that I would encourage singles with who find that themselves in this situation is to trust God. Believe God that his commands are good and do not compromise on his regulations and instructions concerning marriage. Believe God that he's good. By doing this, you will please God. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. And so when you're faced with a situation, you see no other option, you wonder, I don't feel like I'm gifted to remain single. Hold to the standards which God has given and believe in faith that God is a good God and this is his best for you. Because in so doing, you please God. And that's a tremendous thing to be able to do. There's then the person who has the option of marrying and asks the question, should I marry? Or has God intended that I remain single? And this is a much more difficult question to answer, not that it's more difficult to live out, but one more difficult to answer. And there's some important points to be made. Number one, opportunity does not mean it is right to do it. Just because you have the opportunity to marry doesn't mean it's the choice you must make. We daily have opportunity to sin, but we shouldn't. The opportunity to marry must conform to all of God's instruction before it can be even considered an option. Second, wisdom can give us further help, wisdom that comes from Scripture when there are no clear commands. What consequences will a marriage bring? You need to ask the right questions to discover that. Is a person ready to fulfill all of God's commands for the married in light of those consequences? It's good to consider what God has commanded the husband to do. He is to love his wife as Christ loved the church, who gave himself for it. Are you ready to so love your wife that you will die for her, to give up your favorite sports if that's necessary, to change your job if that's important, to fulfill your responsibilities? Are you ready to make that step? If not, then marriage is not the right step for you. Consider the consequences before you make that step. Women, you're instructed to submit to your husband as Christ submits to the church. As the church submits to Christ, you're to submit to your wife. Your wife is supposed to submit to your husband. Boy, I'll get it. In 1 Peter 3, it talks about the woman who finds that her husband is not a believer, or perhaps is a believer, but just disobedient to the word. And says you're supposed to be quiet and not go on and try to convince your husband with words, but by a meek and gentle spirit, let God change his heart. Are you ready to take that step? If you're not ready to hold your tongue and let God work in your husband's heart through your submissive spirit, then marriage may not be the step for you. Consider the consequences before you enter into marriage. A third question to ask is sexual temptation a challenge? Paul, in this context, is addressing specifically this issue. Paul has already said that marriage is a proper option to deal with sexual temptation. It's okay. It's an acceptable reason to consider marriage. To find that a horrible temptation and you're afraid you're going to lose control, well, marriage is an option that God has given for that. As God's created norm, marriage appears to be the normal, I would call default choice. That some things just happen as a normal process. That's what God created. That's okay. When no clear direction is given otherwise, marriage is an okay choice. That's the way God made it. Now let's go back to verse 2. Since marriage is a provision of God, and the sexual relation within marriage is a help against sexual temptation, there are certain principles to be followed in sexual relations within marriage. I'll read verse 2 again. But since there is so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. We find the first principle in verse 2, and it's the principle of fidelity. Marriage is a monogamous relationship of mutual fidelity. Paul's wording strongly implies a monogamous relationship. Marriage is a one-man and one-woman relationship. Each man is to have his own wife. Each woman is to have her own husband. He doesn't just say each man should get married and each woman should get married, implying that, well, a number of marriages are okay. He words it in such a way that pretty much puts a box around it. One man, one woman is the relationship that's intended. And the command only makes sense if fidelity, faithfulness in marriage, is expected. Avoid sexual immorality, is what he's saying, and get married, so that your entire sexual relationship is within the confines of your married life. Paul is giving directions how to avoid sexual immorality. He expects and has already given command in chapter 6. That the married are not to have sexual relations outside of marriage. It is only for marriage. The next principle is in verse 3, the principle of liability. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. Marriage obligates a person to give sexually to the spouse. The phrase in the New International Version, should fulfill his marital duty, could be translated literally, let him keep paying his debt. It's the reason I chose the word liability to describe this principle. You know, in your bookkeeping, you have liabilities and assets, the things you owe and the things that are owed to you. Well, sex is a liability. You owe it to your spouse. Debt is the word that's used here is also the word used in Matthew 18, verse 32, in the parable of the unforgiving servant. We did that here once in an all-aid service. Went through a servant owed his master 10,000 talents of silver. It's called a debt, the same word. It's also used in Romans 13, 7, give everyone what you owe him, taxes, whatever it might be, a debt. The phrase is a euphemism for carrying on sexual responsibilities in marriage. Sex is owed to the spouse. The emphasis, however, is on giving and not on receiving. It's a debt you owe. It's not viewed as the debt your partner owes you. It's worded in a way that puts the responsibility on the one to give to the other. It's not a license to demand whatever you want from the other. It's a command to give to the other what they need and is rightfully theirs. And this was particularly important in the male-dominated Corinthian society, as it is today in some male-dominated thinking. On the one hand, the woman is commanded to give to her husband sexually, but on the other hand, a perspective which men often neglect, a husband is to provide sexually for his wife that which she needs and desires. Men and women are different. Individuals are different. Do you know what satisfies your spouse, or are you just guessing based upon what you like, what your expectations are, what your wants? Or do you know what your spouse wants? The third principle is that of authority. In verse 4, it says, the wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Marriage gives authority over one's body to the spouse. That which Paul teaches here builds upon a quote in chapter 6, verse 16. Through sexual intercourse, it says, the two will become one flesh. This is a principle established in Genesis. It was quoted by Jesus, used by Paul here and in Ephesians 5. A husband and wife are no longer two, but they become one. In fact, in chapter 6, he talks about them become one body. The quote from Genesis says one flesh. This is, you shouldn't join with a prostitute because you become one body with her. Well, if a husband and wife become one body, your body is no longer yours, but your spouse's as well. And for that reason, I think it's good the way New International has translated this in adding a word. It's not yours alone. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. Because there is now just one body, both have a say over it. Neither the husband nor the wife has sole responsibility over his or her body anymore. When they become one, authority is transferred to them both, to the spouse. They now share responsibility and authority for both bodies which have become united. In regard to sexual relations within marriage, male and female are placed on equal levels. The woman is not there merely to satisfy the man. Neither may she use her body to manipulate the man. Sex should not be in the sole control of either the husband or the wife. The fourth principle is that which I have called the principle of priority. Verse 5, do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. The fourth principle is what I have called the principle of priority. I've stated the principle in this fashion. Marriage removes even prayer as a reason to forgo sexual relations unless the pause is brief and by mutual consent. The main clause And hence the thrust of verse 5 is do not deprive each other. It literally means to steal or to defraud. And it plays well off verse 3 that marriage partners have a debt to one another that should be paid. Failing to pay that debt is stealing from the spouse. Do not steal from your spouse by failing to give sexually. Paul offers one exception. A couple may gain time and focus, extra focus for prayer by abstaining from sexual relations. But they must both decide on this action, and it may only be for a limited amount of time. If both do not agree, then one cannot use prayer as an excuse to abstain from sex. Now, think of the logic of what Paul is saying here. If prayer is a high priority in the Christian life, and I think most believers would say yes. And if you ask, I remember an instructor I had in seminary, he was also a pastor. He taught a course on prayer, and he was often invited to conferences. And he made the statement that even at missionary conferences, one of the statements he most often heard were missionaries saying, I believe I should pray more, but I don't know how to do it. We sense in us the importance of prayer. And if prayer is such a high priority in the Christian life, and if even prayer gains only a limited exception to the responsibility of sex and marriage, then there must be very little else that can claim a higher priority. And this is contrary to much of our pious thinking. It's difficult for us to say that sex is more important than prayer. But Paul says that. He says that it's more important if it means that not having sex defrauds the spouse and sets them up for satanic temptation. Now, Paul immediately goes on and applies this to his first group. In verses 8 and 9, now to the unmarried and widows. Now, the group, I think, is the term unmarried is a broad term. It could refer to widowers. It would be a valid term here to refer to widowers, but it's probable, however, in its general sense, intended to be those not bound in marriage. It cannot be taken as a term without exception. In verse 11, it will talk about women, believers, who have separated from their husbands and should remain unmarried and not get remarried. So it's not just a term that means you're free to remarry, but there's no current bond to a legal bond to a spouse. Widows are probably given special mention because they were particularly vulnerable in that society. They had special problems and temptations. It may also have been because Jesus did not address them directly when dealing with the question of remarriage. After my mother died, my dad struggled with this. They had been married for 59 years when my mom died. And the next full tax year, he got a shock that they considered him single. After 59 years, he didn't consider himself single, but he had to pay more taxes. So Paul addresses them special, widows, not unmarried, and this includes you widows as well. Paul's advice to the group summarizes the principles he has just developed. It's okay for them to remain celibate, unmarried, like himself. But sexual passions, if they're not controllable, would advise that they get married. In short, Paul has taught in this section that celibacy is okay, but it's not for the married. Within marriage, abstinence from sex is generally not an option. Celibacy is okay, but is not advisable if sexual temptations are felt to be too strong. Celibacy is okay, but remember that God gives grace to each person in a different manner. It's possible from this text to get some wrong ideas. Paul is addressing a specific question in a specific context. There's further teaching on marriage elsewhere in the Bible, which must be taken into consideration. Sex is not the only reason for marriage. It's not the primary activity of marriage, although these few verses may make it sound that way. It is important. Sex is important within marriage, and especially for a Christian couple in a sex-crazed world. Not only is it so that our culture places an increasing emphasis on sex, it also distorts the sexual relation and nurtures false thinking about sex. Within marriage, we are called to be faithful to our spouses, physically and mentally. In reaction, Christians have likewise developed some false thinking. A husband and wife have become one and have given authority over their body to their spouse. Each becomes obligated. They owe a debt of sexual relations to their spouse. One does not become more pious by avoiding sex. In fact, not even prayer can take priority over sex for a long time. God has given a very beautiful, enjoyable, and significant gift in the sexual relation of a man and woman. I was once given that as an analogy. It was explained it has been wrapped. God has wrapped this gift in the protective package of marriage, where it is to be kept and enjoyed. And may God grant us a proper and balanced understanding in a world gone crazy. Let's pray together.